This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Tonight we're going to talk about cholesterol. This is a challenging subject. I just came from an hour spending on this, discussing this topic with colleagues, physician colleagues, and there's a lot of uncertainty and areas of controversy. And to complicate things, there's a lot of brand new guidelines that really change the way many of us practice medicine in this regard. Now, many of you may be managed by physicians or nurse practitioners or other clinicians who do this a little bit differently. And again, I'm not here to practice medicine, although I do practice medicine, but today I want to mostly talk to you about how I read the medical literature and how we're thinking about this as a medical community, primarily of generalists and primary care physicians who are balancing the needs of individual patients with the needs of society at large. And I'll highlight those aspects as I go through this. Let me say at the outset that I have no relevant conflicts of interest, no conflicts of interest at all related to this subject. Also, most of you whose email we have should have received an email this afternoon with a link to this website. So these slides are now posted, and Dr. Julian's slides from last week are now posted, and we'll continue to do that. Either just before the lecture, preferably, or just after the lecture throughout the course. Of course, these are easy to print if you prefer to have a hard copy, but I think in the name of conservation, we're going to try to do this electronically this year since there are so many of us. Okay, so just a few words about the impact of treating high blood cholesterol in the United States over the last 30 years. Between 1980 and 2000, the death rate fell by about half from heart disease and stroke. In the next 10 years, from 2000 to 2010, it continued to fall down by about a third. Now, when we try to figure out why this rate has gone down, what we can model and analyze is that approximately half of it comes from the fact that we manage acute myocardial infarction, what we call acute coronary syndrome, as well as acute stroke, very differently and much better than we did 10, 20, 30 years ago. So a lot of the lives are saved because of treatment in the community, the early use of highly potent medications and stents and procedures, both for heart disease and stroke. The other half, though, comes from the treatment of risk factors. And this includes all the traditional risk factors, most of which we'll talk about at some point during this course, but certainly in addition to cholesterol, high blood pressure, cigarette smoking, diabetes treatment, and so on, exercise, weight, and so on. When we analyze that half that has improved because of risk factors, half of that, or a quarter of the entire amount, comes from the treatment of high blood cholesterol. Now, one would like to say that this is because we changed our diet or that we started to exercise more, but that's not the case, and we'll talk about that later in the course as we talk about the role nutrition and exercise play in the prevention of these illnesses. But the primary reason why the death rate has gone down for heart disease and stroke in the United States in the last several decades has been the use of medications to treat high blood cholesterol, and this primarily refers to the class of drugs we call statins. So let me begin with that premise. And so I know there's a lot of controversy about statins, but I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about statins. I do not own any stock in statin companies. I would rather treat all patients without medications when I don't have to use medications. But statins do work, and they are more powerful than dietary therapy, and they have led to this very beneficial effect. Now, we're going to spend the rest of the night talking about decisions we make with individual patients. This, though, refers to entire populations of patients. And so you can see if we can decrease the rate of stroke and heart disease by this much over the course of this many years, we prevent a lot of events and save a lot of lives. So from a social aspect, a social justice aspect, a population health aspect, a cost effectiveness aspect, this strategy to treat high blood cholesterol, to prevent heart disease and stroke, is working. It's cost effective, and we're saving lives. Now, what the decision that you as an individual patient or anyone as an individual patient makes may be different. But this is what happens if when we move through recommendations as a population. Now, the way studies have been done to determine that cholesterol-lowering medications work are the classic randomized controlled placebo trials. That is, we take a large number of patients, usually thousands of patients, we give half of them a statin medication in a way they don't know that they're taking it. The other half takes a sugar pill. They don't know which one they're getting. We follow them for 5 years, and we see how they do in terms of heart disease, strokes, life expectancy, and the like. And there have been now almost several dozen studies of this design. This is a slide with some of the early six of them, but the last dozen and a half have been virtually identical. And that is to say that in each study, the patients who are given the cholesterol-lowering medication, in this case statins, versus the sugar pill, had between 25% and, in this case, 38% reduction in events, that is, recurrent heart attacks and recurrent strokes. The take-home message here is that statins reduce events by a quarter or a third. Now, whenever anyone in medicine tells you, or anyone in the news tells you, that something, whether it's a medication or some other intervention, lowers something by a quarter or a third, or any number, your very first question back should be, a quarter or a third of what? This is the central principle of all preventive medicine. Now, for example, if your risk of having heart disease and stroke over the course of the next 10 years or so is very, very low to begin with, for any of the reasons that I'll explain as we go through this, then if we lower that number by a quarter or a third, we haven't done very much. But the harms of any medication stay the same. The costs of the medication stay the same, but the benefit is really small. So what we're looking for are those individuals whose risk of having a heart disease or stroke is very high. And then when we lower that by a quarter or a third, we're really doing something. So much of what we're going to focus on in the rest of this talk is trying to figure out for whom and how should we figure it out, is cholesterol-lowering medicine worth it, that the benefit is worth the harms that we know exist. And we can set that up in terms of a balance beam. We know that cholesterol lowers the risk by a quarter or a third, but there are side effects. Some people get muscle aches. Some people just don't like to take them. There's expense. And so the question is always, it lowers it by a quarter or a third, but what is your native risk? What is your risk of having that event before we start the medication so that we know what we're lowering by a third, a quarter or a third? All right? And that's what's called the difference between the relative risk of a medication working and the absolute risk. In other words, the headline always says, new drug lowers such and so by 10%. But if it's something that doesn't occur very often, then 10% of something that's a low number doesn't matter very much. And so you always have to combine the percent decrease of the treatment and the beginning risk or the native risk in whom that treatment is being used. And that's true if we're talking about cancer screening, blood pressure treatment, cholesterol treatment, and many of the other interventions we'll talk about in this course. Just a few words about women's health as it relates to high blood cholesterol. Early in the studies related to a cholesterol lowering, the subjects were all men. And then for many a series of studies, they were mostly men. And that is still the case. When you put together all the individuals who have participated in the studies, there are still more men than women. And so in many respects, the data is more secure. The evidence is stronger in men than in women for what I'm going to describe. Having said that, though, our current thinking that's based on lots and lots of evidence is that the recommendations for the prevention of heart disease and stroke are the same for men as they are for women in most cases. There are some subtle exceptions. However, the biggest difference is the magnitude of the actual absolute potential benefit. Because I'll show you later on, a woman of, say, 63 years may have a risk that's relatively modest with the same risk factors and cholesterol levels, where the same person changing only their gender may have a 2 or 3-fold increased risk. So it works the same in both people. It lowers the risk by a quarter or a third, but the quarter or a third of what is different at the same age between men and women. Now, as women catch up, usually within a decade or so, the numbers are the same, but there's usually about a decade difference in the absolute risk. So therefore, the absolute benefit at any given age statistically is a greater absolute benefit in men than women. And we'll go through some examples. A few definitions. This is a language that, if you don't work with it every day, is a little bit confusing. LDL cholesterol stands for low-density lipoprotein cholesterol, and it's a fraction of cholesterol that's carried in the blood, and it's the fraction that we think is the most atherogenic, or it's the one that is most associated with heart disease and stroke. And I like to tell the students that the way to remember this is L for lousy. High-density lipoprotein is the good cholesterol. We know that in individuals with a high HDL level, their risk of heart disease is lower. And it's true at any level of LDL. So people with equal LDL levels, even if they're both high, if one also has a high HDL cholesterol, their combined risk is lower because the HDL is protective. And I'll come back to this point, but we've, because of that observation and because in the test tube and in animals, we understand how HDL is part of the recycling, if you will, of cholesterol in the blood, we've always assumed that if we could figure out a way to raise the HDL cholesterol fraction, that people would do better and they'd have less heart attacks and strokes. And unfortunately, that's a very long story, but the punchline is we haven't figured that out yet. So there is really no evidence that medications that raise the HDL cholesterol by itself, as the primary intervention, confer any protection. Triglycerides are a complicated topic. If one likes Clint Eastwood, one could call this the good, the bad, and the ugly. Triglycerides might be the ugly. But I tell the students, for the most part, to put their thumb over the total cholesterol and ignore it, and their thumb over the triglycerides and ignore it, and focus mostly on the LDL and HDL cholesterol. Now, you'll see in some of the equations we use, we do put in the total cholesterol as one of the factors. But the problem is that the total cholesterol is the arithmetic sum of the LDL cholesterol, the HDL cholesterol, and the triglycerides. So you can have a very high total cholesterol and have it be very high because you have a ton of really good HDL. You could have a very high total cholesterol because you have a lot of triglycerides, which I'll come back to in a moment, but aren't that bad in most individuals. Or you could have a really high total cholesterol because the LDL is bad, and that would be bad. So the total cholesterol doesn't give you very much information in an individual patient. In populations of patients, it can be used to differentiate people at relatively lower risk and relatively higher risk. But in an individual patient, it doesn't differentiate sufficiently to tell whether the cholesterol issue is mostly good, mostly bad, or mostly neutral, if you will. When I say triglycerides are neutral, it's a little bit controversial. If we look at all the other risk factors and then either add a high triglyceride or a normal triglyceride, the people with the high triglyceride probably have a little bit of extra risk. But the number is relatively small. And the reason for that is that most people who have high blood triglycerides have it not as a primary genetic disorder, but as a result of something else that's gone amok. And those other things that have gone amok can be captured elsewhere in the equations. For example, the most common causes of high triglyceride is an elevated blood sugar. So people with prediabetes and certainly diabetes that's not well controlled will have a high triglyceride. Alcohol use can raise your triglycerides. Estrogen use, either as a contraceptive or hormone therapy, can raise your triglycerides. And then there are some other diseases like low thyroid, what's called nephrotic syndrome, a type of kidney disease that can do so as well. And then there are also genetic disorders which cause high triglycerides. But if triglyceride was a really bad actor for heart disease and stroke, then one would expect that the individuals that have super high triglycerides because of genetic disorders, and I mean really high, if normal is less than 150, there are people with 10,000. And you would expect those people to be dropping dead like flies, and they don't. And so we don't think that triglyceride per se, in and of itself, is a major factor in whether we're going to treat someone's cholesterol or not. We focus primarily on the LDL and HDL in our thought process. But like I said, we do put in the total cholesterol in our equations to predict risk. And as I'm showing here, total cholesterol does reflect a high triglyceride. Now, there's also other conditions. If your triglyceride is very high, we do recommend treating that to prevent inflammation of the pancreas, what we call pancreatitis. Separate disease, separate medicines, separate conversation, not to be confused with treatment of lipids to prevent heart disease and stroke. And then you'll see on some of the slides HSCRP, that stands for highly sensitive C-reactive protein. That's a measure of inflammation. As you probably have heard over the years, one of the hypotheses related to heart disease and stroke has been that it's an inflammatory condition. This is a controversial area. There are believers and non-believers. And we'll talk about the highly sensitive CRP towards the end of the talk. We don't use it very much as an initial approach, but that could change with new science. It does increase your risk by some amount, but our current guidelines do not recommend doing it routinely, but rather saving it for a tiebreaker when we need a little bit more information in a close call. I'll also include some organizations, and actually one disease and some organizations on some of the slides. So CHD stands for coronary heart disease. It also is known as coronary artery disease, or CAD, and that refers to heart attacks. And in this, when we talk about heart disease outcomes or cardiovascular disease outcomes related to CHD or CAD, we're talking about non-fatal MIs, that is heart attacks from which you do not die, or fatal MIs, that is heart attacks from which you do die. And those are the hard endpoints, if you will, for coronary heart disease. You can also have softer endpoints in some of these studies, like angina, means chest pain, usually with exercise, or how often people have had a stent placed or an operation done. And those are other events that sometimes get measured in some of these studies. But well, for the most part, in some of the conversations we're going to have tonight about estimating risk, we're going to talk mostly about hard CHD endpoints, and by that I mean non-fatal MIs and fatal MIs. Now, if you add stroke to that conversation, both non-fatal and fatal stroke, then we call that more a reflection of cardiovascular disease rather than coronary heart disease. And that's why you'll see CVD instead of CHD. And the AS stands for atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. So when you see that term, which is also one we'll use a lot, that refers to the combination of both heart disease and stroke. Now, this is particularly important, A, because stroke is disabling and a dreaded disease when it's severe, and also because, particularly in women, especially at a certain age, the risk of getting a stroke is not that far away from the risk of having a heart attack. Whereas in men, heart attacks are more common than strokes. So now that we start combining strokes into our thought process, it gives us more events, more things to happen, and I'll come back to this, but it sort of enriches the numerator, if you will. That is, if we're trying to estimate the risk of an event happening, by having stroke in the equation, it increases the events, it increases the risk. And that's relevant to women, and I'll show you some examples of that. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, I think Kathy defined last week, that stands for the abbreviation is the U.S. PSTF, and they're the body of part of the branch of government related called ARC that develops preventive services guidelines and is made up of volunteer physicians and experts. And these days, when the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommends an intervention, it means Medicare pays for it. And if Medicare pays for something, it means most private payers pay for it so that the U.S. PSTF recommendations are extremely important. And then we'll also talk about some recommendations. In fact, the main recommendations tonight that we're going to talk about were published about a year ago now by the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association, two professional organizations, predominantly of cardiologists, but also include lipidologists and preventive medicine experts. So those are some definitions and abbreviations that you'll see throughout the night. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time tonight talking about lifestyle recommendations. I'm going to save that for later in the course. We will definitely talk about heart-healthy diets and exercise and desirable body weights. We won't say too much about tobacco except to say that the single most important thing one can do to prevent any disease practically, but certainly heart disease and stroke, is to avoid tobacco. But the new recommendations do, again, emphasize, not with new information or a change in recommendations particularly, but do recommend the importance of lifestyle recommendations for the prevention of heart disease and stroke. So we continue to advocate for these. And just because I'm talking about the medications tonight rather than this does not isn't intended to create a greater emphasis on one than the other. We will save that, though, for a whole lecture on itself later in the course. It is worth noting, some of you may have heard the headline just this week, that the dietary guidelines experts are now recommending in their draft recommendations the elimination of dietary cholesterol as a bad food as part of the American diet. Most of you are old enough to remember the work in the 60s and 70s that one of the mainstays of a cholesterol-lowering diet was to decrease dietary cholesterol. And people used to get this confused all the time. Dietary cholesterol is what's in an egg, say, what you eat, and blood cholesterol is what you measure in the blood. They're different, same chemical, but they're in different places. They have different significance. And it was always thought that the eating of high dietary cholesterol was a big factor in the development of high blood cholesterol. But it turns out that's not true if you're on a low-fat diet, and it's also highly variable based on genetics. So for many and most individuals, it's not a major factor. So you'll see that language moving out of the dietary guidelines finally in this next draft. We've been recommending the ingestion of eggs for some time. They're an extremely healthy food, especially if you're trying to restrict calories or maximize your protein intake, and as well as many vitamins and minerals. And finally, eggs are sort of back in business, although they've been doing fine for the last several decades. But all right. So when I was a medical student and a junior faculty in the early 1980s, the laboratory here only measured the total blood cholesterol, the total cholesterol, and a normal value was less than 300. So we pretty much ignored cholesterol, and we had an outstanding department of lipid medicine here. We still do, where many of the basic science aspects of lipid disorders were discovered and continue to make scientific advances in lipid metabolism. And so with those who had a cholesterol over 300, that usually meant that they had a genetic disorder. They went to lipid clinic. They got placed on some of the earlier medicines that were available then. But most of us in general medicine or primary care were not doing much to manage high blood cholesterol. In part, diet was hard, drugs were not that effective, and our normal was very high. And then in 1988 came the first government-sponsored recommendations for the management of high blood cholesterol. And ever since then, the recommendations have been revised every 5 to 8 years or so. And most recently was, I think, 2004 until 2013. And part of that was, I think, it took a while to get consensus. There's a lot of controversy in this area. The approach that people who work with lipid molecules is different than people who work with populations of patients. For people like me, sort of in between, interested in both, it's our job to sort out these different tensions and controversies to make recommendations to individual patients. But in 2013, the guidelines were published in a way that will change medical practice. And this has been slowly evolving. It's not based on new science so much as based on a more rigorous analysis of existing science. That is to say, the experts who wrote these guidelines pretty much restricted themselves to looking at those big, sophisticated, randomized trials that I described at the beginning. 10,000 patients, half get cholesterol-lowering medicine, half get sugar pill, what happens? And so it's a little bit less of an analysis of what happens in a test tube, what happens at the molecular level, what happens with animals, what should happen in people based upon that, what happens in populations if we just follow them without an intervention. All that knowledge exists and is sort of around these recommendations, but the recommendations really rely on the highest quality of evidence, which are randomized clinical trials, or RCTs. So the recommendations take a very complex area and simplify it a little bit by identifying really just 5 new factors, and they're suggested here. Number one, it's more precise in defining, based upon the randomized trials, which patients are likely to benefit from taking statins. Secondly, it takes all the existing statins and divides them into 3 categories: high intensity, moderate intensity, and low intensity, and basically says, forget the low intensity. That most of the randomized trials have been done with moderate and high intensity, and that's what we should stick with, and I'll define that. The biggest change, or one of the biggest changes, and probably the biggest change from a patient point of view, is that there's no LDL treatment targets. In addition, there's no longer an LDL treatment goal. So depending on which conversation you had when with your physician, he or she probably said to you, your LDL is 113, and therefore I don't think it's worth it to put you on a cholesterol-lowering medicine. or they might have said, your cholesterol is 165. I think we need to start a cholesterol-lowering medicine. It was based on the actual measured LDL level. And we used to joke about this and try to create a memory tool for the students and make it into a song, which was 100, 130, 130, 160, 160, 190, because that represented three risk groups and a starting point and the treatment goal point. And we had some controversy whether the treatment goal should be less than 100 or less than 70. Usually we said less than 100, but if we can get to less than 70, that was better. But we really focused on the goal. And now we're not going to do any of that. We're not going to treat based upon what your cholesterol level is, except in one exception. And we're not going to follow what that level is, except in one exception. And I'll go through all this. In addition, in the old way of doing this, if the statins didn't get us to a goal, then we would add a second drug. Now, that makes sense. That's what we do for high blood pressure. That's what we do for diabetes. That's what we do for all sorts of things. We start with one drug, we measure, we add a second drug. And we'll talk about that next week with high blood pressure. It's standard practice. But as I'll show you, or at least describe, the evidence for non-statin therapies, that is the medications and other classes, do not work that well. Do not provide acceptable risk reduction. What do I mean by that? That's the resins, that's niacin, that's the fibric acid derivatives, and that's ezetimibe or Zetia. And I'll list those again for you later. They all work a little bit by themselves, but when added to a statin, they either do not contribute very much or actually do harm. And again, we'll go over that. And the final thing that's new, and this is very confusing and controversial and unresolved, is that everyone for whom we are considering the treatment of high blood cholesterol should have their 10-year risk of cardiovascular disease estimated. Now, this is new in a couple of respects. For about the last decade or so, we've recommended that almost all patients have their risk of heart disease, CHD, estimated as part of our treatment algorithm. But now we're going to do it, A, for everyone, and B, we're going to include stroke as well as heart disease. So that's now why you're seeing the V, the CVD, instead of CHD. And as I implied, because now you have more events in the numerator, you're going to have higher rates or higher risk estimates. So we're measuring an additional set of illnesses to estimate your risk. We're still using the 10-year approximation, and we'll go over that in some detail. So those are the 5 points, and I'll go through each of those in some detail. But just again, to summarize, only a limited number of patients who benefit. Use the high-intensity and moderate-intensity statins pretty much exclusively. We're going to come up with a different set of reasons to treat rather than the LDL target, and we're not going to follow the LDL very often. We're going to use less of the other drugs, and we're going to use an equation to estimate risk in everyone. All right, so this is one of the studies that was on that first slide. It's one of the earlier generation of studies, but I like it because it taught us some important stuff back quite a ways ago that was recognized by many of us, but never really made it into the guidelines until this current iteration. If you look at the green dot in this slide, so the way this works is, again, same thing, about 5,000 patients. Half of them get statin, in this case simvastatin. The other half get a sugar pill. We see what happens after 5 years or so. Anything to the left of the solid line means that there's been a reduction in risk with statins. And you can see the green diamond is for all the patients, all the subjects, and it shows a 24% reduction with fairly narrow confidence intervals, suggesting that, like I said, cholesterol lowering with statin drugs lowers your risk of events by a quarter. Now, what was interesting about this particular study is that when we broke down, it was big enough to break down into groups. And the patients who had a cholesterol over 130 at the beginning of the study did great. They lowered their risk by a quarter. No surprise there. That's our treatment focus. But then we saw that patients whose cholesterol was less than 130 but over 100 also did better. And sure enough, it was about the same number, about a quarter. But most interesting of all was that the people whose cholesterol was less than 100 who were treated with a statin medication and followed for 5 years also had a quarter reduction in events. So this is the kind of evidence that suggests that it doesn't matter what your cholesterol is. What matters is, are you on a statin, and is your risk high enough to merit being on a statin? So that big number rather than that tiny number. So this and many other studies like this helped emphasize that point, that statins and statins work no matter what your starting cholesterol level is, it brings it down. Now, as I said, the guidelines say that there are only four groups of patients who benefit from statins. That sounds simple, but these are big groups. So there are a lot of people who qualify for statins, millions of people, and I'll show you some of the data in a minute. But in these four groups are some of the ongoing controversies. Now, we have believed for some time, and the studies are quite strong, and they're strong in both men and women, that individuals who already have evidence of cardiovascular disease, that is a prior stroke, or at least an ischemic stroke, and heart disease, benefit from being on a statin. There are other medicines they also benefit from, aspirins, beta blockers, ACE inhibitors, and so on, depending on the circumstance, but they also benefit from being on cholesterol-lowering medicine with a statin. And so that's been a consensus for quite some time since the earliest days of these reports. This is the group we are most confident in. If you take a statin, you have a much lower chance, by a quarter or a third, of having an event, a recurrent event. And because you've already had an event, your risk of another event is really high. So therefore, that's the group in whom lowering a quarter or a third really matters. So that one's straightforward, no controversy there. The second group are those with genetic disorders. So if your bad cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, is really, really high, then you almost certainly have a genetic disorder, a family history, and those are people for whom the evidence suggests should be on statin medications. Exactly starting at what age is controversial, but generally people think that at least at a certain age, people should be on statin-lowering medications, although this guideline does not tell us what that age should be. So there are some pediatricians who will treat. There are some internists who will treat young adults. Interestingly, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force makes recommendations about screening. And in order to recommend screening, they have to have evidence of benefit. And they recommend screening for high blood cholesterol in men starting at age 35 if there are no other risk factors. That is no obesity, diabetes, smoking, high blood pressure, and so on. In women, they say 45. Now, if there are other risk factors, they say screen earlier. And the Heart Association says, forget that, let's screen everyone at least at 21. But it is worth noting that from age 21 to 35, there is a controversy, and certainly in children, a controversy as to whether these genetic disorders need to be treated early in life or can start middle of life or a little bit earlier. That is to say, the conceptual issue here is 40 years of taking a statin better than 10? Right, that's really a question we don't have an answer to. Now, when most of you were growing up, you may remember hearing about Korean War veterans who at age 18 or 22 on the battlefield in Korea who died were found to have fatty streaks in their blood vessels. And that kind of thinking gave rise to the idea that atherosclerosis was this disease whereby your vessels were a pipe, and when you were a kid and young adult, bad dietary practices would give you some fat deposition, and every time you had butter or cheese or ice cream, you lay down a little bit more, and then eventually you had that final steak, it clotted off, you had your heart attack, and you died. And that was the image of atherosclerosis that we not only grew up with, but that I learned in medical school. I mean, that was the concept. It was a pipe theory of atherosclerosis. And so with the pipe theory of atherosclerosis, it made sense that earlier the better, right? If you could prevent that plaque from forming, the better. And in fact, there's still a lot of cardiology based upon pipe theory, right? We put in stents to keep pipes open. And there are a lot of cardiologists who will do that at relatively modest amounts of blockage. What we don't know, however, what we now think, though, is that at least a good chunk of heart disease, if not a big chunk of it, is actually due to other factors, that the plaque itself is fragile and unstable, and it breaks off, and then sometimes there's new plaque that's more unstable, an older plaque that's more stable, and it has to do with the plaque and tears in the plaque and the lining of the blood vessel and what platelets are doing and other clotting factors. And so it's a much more complicated process, and that's why other medicines are involved in the conversation, like aspirin and Plavix-type drugs and so on. So the unknown question is still, is 40 years better than 10 years? And so the ideal, if you could predict the future, based upon what we currently know, what the day you would want to start taking your statin is 10 years before you were going to have your first heart attack or stroke. Right? Because everything we know about cholesterol lowering is based on 10-year studies. So the problem is we can't predict that accurately yet. So we estimate it with various equations. And we're going to spend some time talking about those equations in a few minutes. The third group are patients with diabetes. This is also not new. We know that patients with diabetes predominantly die of heart disease and strokes. And there are good studies that suggest that lowering cholesterol in these people prevents those heart disease and strokes. The studies suggest that we don't have to treat really young people with diabetes necessarily, unless they have compelling family histories of premature heart disease. But certainly the majority of diabetics, and that, by this I mean type 2 diabetics between age 40 and 75, should be treated with a cholesterol-lowering medication, i.e. a statin. Now, you'll note both here and in the next bullet that the age limit stops at 75. So what's that about? Well, the main thing it's about is that there are no clinical trials in this disease that have included people over 75, or at least not many. And high blood pressure, it's a different story. You can almost never be too old to treat high blood pressure, and I'll show you that next week. But with cholesterol, if this were a room of 55-year-olds and I measured your LDL, I could put you in different parts of the room, pretty accurately predict your risk of having a heart attack based upon that one number. But as you get into your eighth decade, that's no longer true. That is to say, high blood cholesterol does not predict heart attacks and strokes in people over 75. So what I do is if a patient makes it to 75 without evidence of heart disease or stroke, and they're taking a statin medication, and they would like to discontinue that medication, I offer that as a 75th birthday present. Now, I must say, most of my patients don't accept that present. Because most people have been on the drug for a while. It's not that expensive. If they had a lot of side effects, they already stopped. So if they're still taking it, there are no side effects. They're doing fine with it. And most people will say, well, I'm doing fine. Why rock the boat? But the truth is that the evidence to say that there's benefit conferred at that age in that population is relatively little. That's not true if you have a heart attack or stroke. So in that top bullet, we treat throughout the life cycle until you get to the point you're at the very end of life. Now, the final bullet is the most controversial, and this is what we call primary prevention. You don't have evidence of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease or diabetes. You're in that middle range of age. Your cholesterol is not super, super low. It's what we used to call at goal or above. And we calculate your risk, and your risk is above some arbitrary number. Now, one of the things that makes medicine, this type of preventive medicine that we're going to talk about, particularly this week and next week and in my final presentation, is that when we look at things like cholesterol or blood pressure or weight, these are all continuous biologic variables. That is to say, the risk of having an elevated body mass index or an elevated LDL cholesterol or an elevated blood pressure is curvilinear. It increases starting at relatively low levels and just increases steadily and then gets steep at the highest levels. There's some areas of controversy about that. Maybe we'll talk about that in the context of obesity. But in general, these are biologic continuous variables. So anytime we draw a line and say the magic number is a BMI of 30 or a blood pressure of 140 or 150 or an LDL of 100 or 130, it's arbitrary, right? And so that's why when experts get together and come up with guidelines and recommendations, there are people who have different opinions because they're arbitrary. And you can draw the line in all sorts of places. And so what we're trying to do is always balance benefit and harm, and including both the risks of the harms being the risks of medication and the expense, and the benefits being that which we've discussed. So these are the four groups of patients. The first one is easy. If you got the disease, we're going to treat you with a variety of medications, including statin. If you have a genetic disorder and a striking family history, then we definitely want to give you the benefit of treatment. If you have diabetes, we think treatment prevents stroke and heart disease. And then if you haven't had anything yet, but your risk adds up to a number that's above some threshold that we'll discuss, then we also recommend cholesterol-lowering medication. Now, the threshold for 10 years used to be 10%. These new guidelines, they said 7.5%. Why? I wasn't in the room. Some people say people had conflicts of interest related to their research and work with industry, but those were disclosed and I think attempted to be resolved. But nonetheless, I think it's an arbitrary decision to pick any one number in this conversation. I think if you polled physicians and the number was 20%, you would get a high concordance of agreement that 20% is too high. And the reason we think 20% is too high is because that's about the risk of having a recurrent MI or stroke if you've already had one. So that's that top bullet. So if we get to that high, then we think you're high enough. So there I think there's be pretty good consensus. Whether that number then should be 15, 10, or 7.5, that's where we don't know the correct answer and we're sort of guessing. But it has to do with, and it also has to do with this tension, this dialectic, if you will, between what's good for an individual patient and what's good for the population as a whole. Because the more people we treat, even though it may not benefit any one of us, if the whole society has less heart attacks and strokes, then we collectively benefit. So that's where the tension is in this conversation. Now, as I mentioned, not only has the number gone down from 10% to 7.5%, but now we're also including strokes. So it's more likely for you to be over 7.5% or over 10%, right? Because now there are more things that we're counting to get you there. So those are the controversies. So these new guidelines lead to more people being on cholesterol-lowering medicine rather than less. The good news is next week I'll tell you about some new guidelines for high blood pressure, which actually suggests less people being on medication for high blood pressure. Now, as I mentioned, part of the guidelines are to divide the statins into high intensity, moderate intensity, and low intensity, and I'll define that in just a moment. But for most conditions, we want patients to benefit from the highest intensity of the drug if they can tolerate it. And we know if anyone has ever been hospitalized or had a family member hospitalized with a heart attack or stroke, every patient in the United States virtually will get 80 milligrams of atorvastatin or an equivalent statin as part of the treatment of their acute stroke an acute heart attack. And because there are studies that show that your short-term outcomes are better. So in primary care, if you've never been on a statin and you come back to my office, you're on 80. So I don't have much to say about what dose to start because it was already indicated when you were in the hospital. But for some of these other patients, we do start in the office. And there's a debate whether to start low and slow, go slow and build up, or pick some number and start. And we'll come back to that. But you'll see with individuals who have the disease, who have clinical ASCVD, we use a high-intensity statin. You can lower the dose in people who are older to prevent side effects. People with the genetic disorders, we use a high-intensity statin, so not much variety here. People with diabetes, we use a high-intensity statin if the risk is over 7.5% of having an event in 10 years, which includes almost all diabetics. So so most of them will get a high-intensity statin. And for primary prevention, they sort of hedge their bets and says, we're not sure, so you can use either. But don't use a low intensity. So you can see as you go through this list, most people should be on, all people should be on a moderate or high-intensity statin, and most of the conditions merit a high-intensity statin. Well, here they are, and again, this is very evidence-based, meaning these are the drugs that we use in the clinical trials. Now, these are the generic names. And in the high intensity, it's defined by it lowers your LDL on average by 50%. So if your LDL cholesterol is 160, if you take these doses shown on the top bullet, your cholesterol will go down to 80 on average. And conversely, if you use the lower dose or the moderate intensity or the other drugs, it lowers LDL a bit less, by a third to a half. On this list, all of them are now generic with the exception of rosuvastatin, which is a trade name Crestor. So that's still on patent. But the others are available generically. And depending on the dose in this category are relatively equivalent. Now, you'll note that we are not recommending that people take 10 milligrams or 20 milligrams of lovastatin, or 20 milligrams of pravastatin, or 5 or 10 milligrams of simvastatin. Those are off the list because those don't give you the benefit of this intense cholesterol lowering. The side effects do increase with dose, mostly the side effects of muscle aches, sort of symmetrical, proximal, is close to your inner, your core muscle aches. Many of the other side effects are rare, and we don't worry as much about liver disease as we used to. We don't recommend checking liver enzymes anymore for ongoing therapy. It's mostly muscle aches that people complain about, and that can be 10, 15, 20% of patients on high dose. Now, this is more for doctors than for patients, but if you're a doctor and you like to use medicines that are generic, and patients would fit in that category too. From the patient point of view, you only need one drug and one dose. But from the doctor's point of view, the point I'm trying to make is that atorvastatin is particularly convenient here because it covers both categories. So it's the only generic drug in both categories. Now, that doesn't mean that if you're on a moderate intensity statin, that atorvastatin is better than the other ones listed there. They're equivalent. So I'm not suggesting that you switch by any means. But if a doctor wants to master one drug in their armamentarium, in their toolbox, then atorvastatin is an easy one because you can either start high or start low, and you get pretty quickly to either moderate or high intensity. When patients come out of the hospital, as I described, on 80, we can either keep them on 80, or if they're having side effects, we can lower them to 40 and still call it high-intensity statins. So that's something that's a possibility. Conversely, you can start people in the office with 10 and raise them to 20 or 40, depending on which category they fall in. Or there are some doctors that say, I'm just going to put everyone on 40 and see what happens. So big systems who are looking for simple approaches will often say, well, let's just pick 40, atorvastatin 40. If people get side effects, we can go down. If not, we're done. And so there are a lot of simple approaches here. But certainly if you're on the appropriate dose of lovastatin, pravastatin, simvastatin, and rosuvastatin, that's totally fine. We don't think that any one of these is better than the other. They're just more potent at lowering LDL cholesterol. So the betterness, if you will, the advantage is based on the intensity of lipid lowering, not something specific to atorvastatin versus rosuvastatin, for example. Let me digress a little bit and now talk about this issue of risk calculation. Because remember, this whole premise is based on the fact if your risk is high, it's time to move. If your risk is low, we have time to wait. As you get older, your risk is going to get higher. So waiting now doesn't mean you're off the hook, because age is the single most important predictor of risk. Now, in the old days, and by that I mean the last decade, we have measured risk for patients with lipid disorders in almost all cases. Certainly, we have taught that in our own practices, and the recommendations more or less follow that. But it's worth noting that the old Framingham risk calculator, which is the standard one, until last fall, or two Decembers ago, if you had your risk calculation done, you probably went to the ATP3, the cholesterol website, National Cholesterol Education Program website, or some handheld smartphone website app, and calculated your risk. But you probably didn't know the answer to some of these questions shown on this slide. For example, did the calculator include hard outcomes, that is MI, non-fatal MI, and fatal MI, non-fatal MI, and stroke? Or did it include things like angina or stents or things like that? Was it measuring CHD, or did it include CVD, that is stroke? Did it include diabetes? Some did, some didn't. Peripheral vascular disease, which is a predictor of bad outcomes. Race and ethnicity, almost none of them did. Family history and or CRP, only one of the risk scales does. Did it ask for an exact number or a range of numbers? Did you do it on a by paper, counting up points, or on a computer or a phone app? So these were all variables that existed even before the new risk calculator came out. And I tell this story because the new risk calculator is imperfect. And the point here is that the old risk calculator was already imperfect. So now we're trying to decide the best of two imperfect tools. But it's not like we went from a perfect tool to a mediocre tool. That's sort of the point of this paragraph. Now, the most important thing that's absent in a lot of this is what does the patient want to do? And so, as you'll see as we go through these numbers, the advantage of taking these drugs for an individual patient is relatively modest. And I'll illustrate this towards the end with some shared decision-making tools. So patients absolutely must make a decision for themselves whether the risk is worth it or the benefit is worth it for you. Because for some cases, it's a slam dunk. And if you say, doc, well, what do you think? Well, if you have had a heart attack, I'm going to say you should take the medicine. But if you say my risk is, 10.5, what do you think? I say, well, let's talk about it. And we'll try to find that middle ground because the issues are not so clear. So this is what we call shared decision making. So this is where you find the new calculator. This is what came out in December 13. So this particular website is the Heart Association website, but it's pretty easy to Google risk calculator. But if you want the new one, get it from the Heart Association, because, again, some of the commercial ones that are available and some of the others have some of those assumptions that I showed a couple of slides ago, and you may not know exactly what you're getting. With this one, what you're getting is measurement of these factors. And they're the things that we, for the most part, think are important. So age, gender, race, at least white and African American, it does not deal with ethnicity. Total cholesterol, which again incorporates a little bit of both your LDL and your triglycerides, if you remember the equation, the HDL cholesterol, your blood pressure, whether you're on medications for blood pressure, whether you have diabetes, and whether you use tobacco. And the outcome, as I said, is the 10-year risk of CVD, or cardiovascular disease, which includes fatal and non-fatal MI and strokes. So when they came up with this list, they said, this is the state of the art, right? This is the best we can do. And we developed this, they said, from five cohort studies. Cohort studies are like the Framingham Heart Study, or a study where you define a group at the beginning. In that case of Framingham, it was people who lived in Framingham, Massachusetts. Measure a bunch of things, follow them forward for a bunch of years, and see who develops what kind of event and what of the original measurements predict those events. That's called a cohort study or an observational study. And so they looked at the five studies and said, all right, these are the things that we think predict the best. And so we're going to come up with this new tool, and we think it, because it's going to include things like race, include stroke, include diabetes, and so on, we think it's going to be a little bit more accurate than the old one. The problem is then they tested it in three other studies, and since then, you know, going forward, what we call prospectively, that is studies that were not used to develop the model. And since then, there have been, seven total, in which the new calculator has been tested. And it turns out the new calculator overestimates risk in most populations, most groups of patients. Not necessarily for an individual patient, but for groups of patients, like middle-aged women or older men or whatever you can define it. And I've taken out the slides that show you which calculator is better for which groups of patients, because it's still preliminary data. But the point of this slide is from three studies. The light bar suggests what the predicted rate would be, this entire gray bar, and the dark gray represents what it was actually observed. And you can see that depending on what the risk calculator was, it overestimated the risk in each of these studies by a fairly high percent, somewhere almost about double in most of these examples. And some of the recent studies, another one was just published this week, continue to show that. So most people think, although not everyone, most people think that the new calculator, as it's currently written, overestimates risk. And that maybe some other method of estimating risk would be better. Now, in the old days, what we used to do was count risk factors. You know, you had six risk factors, and if you had two or more, we put you in the highest risk category. And then there was, if you had less than 0 or 1, it was the low-risk category. This is all better than that. So we have made progress, but we haven't nailed it yet. Now, if you use the new calculator, so the ACC-AHA stands for the new calculator, and the ATP-3 stands for the old calculator based upon the Framingham Heart Study, what you can see is most of the increase, that is, these bars represent the number of people who would be on medications, that most of the increase represents individuals age 60 to 75 who don't have the disease. That is to say, this brown group here are those who are in this based upon the risk equation or primary as opposed to diabetes, genetics, or coronary or having the disease. You can see that this added increase here are individuals age 60 to 75 who have not yet had the disease. And in fact, for a man with almost perfect risk factors, at about 63, 65 or so, you bump above the 7.5% just based on age and gender. So that's really weird, right? So now you have someone who's 65 or 70, 72, who for the last 5 or 10 years I've been telling your LDL is, you know, 102. You don't need to be on a statin because your cholesterol is not that high, and you're fine. And now, just based on the risk, the recommendation would change. So the question is that the right thing to do or not? And the answer is we don't know yet. But that's why if you've gotten any curveballs lately, where a clinician told you, after telling you, look, your lipids are not a problem, now all of a sudden they're saying, well, you should be on a statin anyway, this is where it comes from. So what I'm doing right now, when I have the time with patients, or what I ask patients to do on their own, is look up both calculators and use that to frame the discussion. And I'll show you a website that has both calculators on it in just a moment. So, and we don't know, and I'll show you some examples in two cases. We don't know yet exactly how they're going to act in different patients. In general, though, the overestimation is greater in women than in men, and I'll show you some examples of that. Now, there's a website that the Mayo Clinic has put together called the Statin Choice Decision Aid, and you can Google that phrase and find this quite easy. But here's the link if, or the website if you want. But just Google Mayo Clinic Statin Choice Decision Aid, and I'll show you a screenshot of it in a few slides. But this has both the old Framingham risk calculator and the new ACC Heart Association calculator, and so you can put in both the numbers in both and see how you do. And again, you may come up with exactly the same number, or you may find that there's a range. That difference may matter or may not, and I'll show you some examples as we go through this. This website also has some very interesting tools to help you make the decisions, and I'll show you an example of that towards the end. Okay, so let me give you some examples of how this plays out in real life. So this first case is a 63-year-old woman who's had a heart attack. So she's got the disease. She's in that first group. There's a consensus she should be on a statin. So even though her LDL cholesterol is not that high, we used to say under 130 was pretty normal, we would still recommend that she go on a statin. And that's because her risk of having another MI is pretty high, probably about 20% a year. Not 20% per 10 years, so 2% a year. And she falls into this category. She's an individual who has the disease. And so the recommendation, again, I'm just repeating, the recommendation is to treat with a high-intensity statin, or if she's older, which she's not, a moderate-intensity statin. So she would have gotten 80 milligrams of atorvastatin or the equivalent in the hospital when she had her MI, if it was recent. And she could either continue on 80 if she's doing okay or back down to 40, but not much lower. So atorvastatin 40 is the only drug on this list of choices that is in the high-intensity group. That's the point of this question. She needs high-intensity. That's the only one in the group that is high-intensity. Number six would have been the right answer a year and a half ago, so or 2 or 3 years ago, whatever would get her down less than 70. But now we don't care about what she is as long as she's reduced by 50%. From her starting point. This is a 63-year-old woman who also has had a prior MI, heart attack, and she's already on atorvastatin 80. Her LDL cholesterol is 95. Her HDL is not bad, like it a little higher in a woman. Triglycerides a little high, but not too bad. And but usually we would have said a year and a half ago, 95 is okay, but we'd really prefer less than 70. There's a little bit of added advantage in preventing events when you compare a 95, getting less than 95 or getting less than 70 in the old system. So we might have said, well, let's, some of the choices are we could either keep her on recurrent therapy, we could switch it to rosuvastatin, or in the old days, and both of those turned out to be the right answers, in the old days, we might have said, well, let's add another drug. And the choices we might have had are fenofibrate, fish oil works to lower triglycerides. In particular, niacin was always a very favorite choice, especially around here back a half decade or so, because it lowered triglyceride, it raised HDL, it lowered LDL. It was a great second drug, we thought. And also ezetimibe or Zetia is on the list. The problem is that even though we think these second drugs should work, should add more value, when each one has been studied, the studies have been negative. So very good science where you take people on a statin, who are high risk, treat them with statin plus one of these other drugs, particularly niacin or fenofibrate, and they do not do better. And in fact, in one of the niacin studies, they did worse. They had more strokes and heart attacks, and the study was stopped before it was finished. So we no longer recommend adding a second drug to a statin. So just to summarize, a lot of complicated studies in a slide and a half. Just what do we know about lipid-lowering drugs at this point? We've said enough about statins already. They work based on randomized trial data. There's no evidence to support adding niacin or fibrogast derivatives on top of statins. If patients completely cannot take statins, and they have to really prove it, or don't want to for whatever reason, although we would try to work through that and try to see, depending on the indication, both statins and fibrogast derivatives can have some benefit, but it's much less potent than statins. So niacin and fibrogast derivatives. And ezetimibe, traditionally, most of the studies have shown that it has very little clinical impact. To complicate things, though, in November of this year, a new study was presented at the Heart Association meetings called the IMPROVE-IT study. And this has not yet been published. It's been discussed as an abstract, so we don't know yet. We need to see the study in its full glory. But it's a large study. These are patients who had coronary heart disease, and they were randomized to simvastatin versus simvastatin plus ezetimibe. This combination is marketed as Vytorin. Usually these studies last for about 5 years, and we call it a day. 5 years, this was a negative study. But they kept going, and at 7 years, they were able to find a small difference with the combination therapy. But it was a very small difference. It was 34.7% events versus 32.7%, so it's 2% absolute difference, and it's about a 6% benefit. Remember, the statins are a quarter or a third. So we think when we see this study in its glory, it won't influence practice, but we'll have to see. I think certainly the drug company is going to try to get the FDA to approve this for a new indication based upon this data. It may well get approved. But my personal opinion is if this data is the whole story, then it probably shouldn't be used with the added expense and the modest benefit, if any. So we're still stuck with statins for the most part. So this patient falls into this category again. She's had an MI. And so what we would recommend for her is either leave her alone on her atorvastatin, even though she's not less than 70, which was our goal not that long ago. We would now leave her alone and say, continue your medication and don't worry about it. You could also switch to rosuvastatin, but again, it's off patent, it's on patent, and there'll be formulary hassles and there may be additional expense. You could try it if you wanted to, because it may unpredictably have a more potent effect. That is, you can't predict. Remember, I say 50%, but there's a range, the Gaussian distribution around the 50%. So sometimes you get lucky and one drug is more effective than another. But my own practice would be, say, you're doing great, let's leave it as it is. But the take-home point here is that we no longer add niacin or fibric acid derivatives or other medicines. All right, the last case is a woman with primary prevention. This is a 63-year-old woman, no other risk factors. She doesn't smoke, no blood pressure, no diabetes. Blood pressure is normal. Her LDL cholesterol is 155, and you say, well, that's getting up there. Her HDL is a little protective, 55. Average in women is about just under 45. Triglycerides are high normal. And so if you look at this from the end of the bed, you might say, well, she might merit therapy. She's in her 60s. LDL is pretty high. I don't know. What should we do? And the answer is, let's figure out what her risk is, because we can't guess. And if we guess, it's just a guess. So we're going to calculate, but we have to now calculate with the uncertainty of not knowing which calculator and what we're going to do exactly with the number when we get it. So again, here are some choices for her. So when you do the Framingham calculator, the old calculator, her risk of an event in 10 years is 2%. That is, it's 0.2% per year. So that's one of these. That's one of these small numbers that if we lower that by a quarter, we go from 2% to 1.5%, right, or 0.15% per year. So it's quite low, and when you do the inverse of that absolute difference, you can figure out what's called the number needed to treat, and you'd have to treat a lot of patients that just like her to prevent one heart attack. So that's where that whole thinking is that, gee, that's just not worth it. Interestingly, if you put in the new calculator, she's one of these people where the risk is more than double on the new calculator. And again, part of that is because stroke is now included, and women at this age have a higher risk of stroke. But this is an example where the fact that the two calculators are imperfect doesn't matter because the number is small in both counts. You with me? So even though she's of age and has a relatively high LDL, the answer is no. So she doesn't merit a lipid-lowering medication. Now, what's interesting is if we do the same case but make it a man, everything else is the same. All the numbers are the same. His risk is 10% on the old calculator instead of 2% and 10.8% on the new calculator. Again, men get a lot more heart attacks than strokes, so therefore the numbers are a little more similar. We don't know if this is an overestimation of his risk. I'm reassured that it's showing up on both calculators. In the old system, 10% was our threshold. Now we're saying 7.5%. But these are close to calls, right? And so we don't, you know, this is what I would call a clinical toss-up. And when there's a clinical toss-up, it's what the patient wants is what carries the day. So if they say, Doc, what would you do? I'd have to figure out some way to say, well, patient, what would you do? And try to understand a little bit how much of a risk taker they are, how risk averse they are, whether they're more concerned about benefit or side effects, and so on, and work that through. Now, if one had all the time in the world, and if you're at home trying to figure this out for yourself, you do. Although in the office, your doctor may not. You should go to this Mayo website or something like it and try to play with these numbers. So here's what it looks like with some happy faces and sad faces. So if the risk, in this example, I put in these numbers for one of the calculators. So first of all, up here, this is that Mayo thing that I told you about. So it's a three-step process. So current risk gives you the two calculators, and you can put in both numbers. It also gives you a third calculator just to confuse you. To do the third calculator, you need another blood test, which is the CRP. And so most of us don't recommend using the CRP routinely, but it is available. It's not that expensive, and it may be a good tiebreaker. If the CRP is high, it increases your risk by another 20 or 30%. If it's really low, it lowers it by another 20 or 30%. It doesn't take you from 10 to 25%. It takes you from like 10 to 13 or 10 to 7. So again, it may or may not make the difference, and you have to decide that before you do the blood test. So you actually have three calculators to play with, and the study that just came out this week compared all three calculators, and for different populations, each of them was slightly better in different settings. In that particular study, the third calculator, the so-called Reynolds calculator, performed well. Here's this person who has, I put in the numbers, so 10.8%, same numbers, rounded off to 11 on the new calculator. And this is without a cholesterol-lowering medicine. And you can see that although 11 people will have a heart attack in 10 years, and one-tenth will have a heart attack in 1 year, the vast majority of people, even though the numbers are bad and the risk is high, will have a good outcome. Smiley faces. So it's very important to understand that as an individual patient, the odds are still in your favor, even if your risk is moderately high. If this were even 20%, even if you had another heart attack, it's still, remember, If your risk is 20% of having an event, it means 80% is not. So your odds are 4-1 in favor. So now if you take the drug, is meant these blue ones. I see three blue ones. So you've lowered it from 11 to 8, and that's that quarter or a third reduction. And this is with a moderate statin. On the high-dose statin, it might be 4 out of 8. And you can see that when you look at it this way, it doesn't look so good, right? Because your odds are still pretty good, right, that you're in this other category. So it really depends whether you're how you feel about your odds and whether you want to take a drug, which probably won't have any side effects in the vast majority of patients, that lowers your risk somewhat, but is not a cure-all, and your odds weren't that bad to begin with. So this is what's called a shared decision-making tool, and I think it really helps people understand what we're dealing with here. So please feel free to play with this website. It's free. All the yellow ones are possible, are good possibilities for this patient for one reason or another, and I won't go through them again. Now, I've tried to make it simple. Of course, nothing is ever as simple as it seems. There are various reasons why doctors would take exception to these guidelines in an individual patient, and they're shown here. Certainly, if the family history is striking, I think all of us would pay attention to that. Interestingly, most of the scales don't take much account of family history because of the way the data was collected. And some of these other tests I won't go into in great detail. But we do not recommend using a CRP routinely or a coronary calcium score routinely, but when available, they both add some additional information. So just to summarize this part of the talk, and I'm almost at the end, the new guidelines have a lot of good parts to them. They continue to focus on healthy lifestyle. They focus on statins and off away from other agents that have been shown not to be effective. They teach us to focus on people based on their risk. And they tell us to treat patients that should be greater than 190, sorry about that, or who have diabetes and cardiovascular disease. Now, not having an LDL target is controversial, but it makes sense. And again, this idea that 25% of what is the central question here. And so you don't need the LDL target so much. What you need to know is the risk. The problem is we still don't know how best to calculate the risk. And our current state of the art is to use these various calculators and then pick a treatment threshold. But which calculator we use and what treatment threshold we use is where the controversies lay. Now, let me end with one other curveball. Now, I'm not going to go into great detail. This is a new paragraph. This is a totally different issue. Most of you have heard back over the last decade of certain anti-inflammatory medications or non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medicines like ibuprofen and Aleve and so forth, that there are some medicines in this class, like Vioxx, that have been taken off the market because they caused increased risks of heart disease. Well, it turns out that Vioxx was certainly one of the worst culprits, but there are several lines of evidence to suggest that all of these drugs, when taken in high doses for long periods of time, let me say that again, high doses, long periods of time, so this is not 3 weeks because your shoulder hurts or every third day because your back hurts, but high doses, long periods of time, increases the risk of heart disease and stroke and increases the death associated with that and highly statistically significant, about 40 to 50%. And there may be a difference between some of them. Some of the studies show that the naproxen-type drugs and the ibuprofen-type drugs, the ones that are over-the-counter, may be safer than the ones that are on prescription, but there's evidence the other direction also. Pretty much they all sort of probably increase risk to some extent. Now, the take-home message here is that risks are competing. So that if you take some of these patients that we've been discussing, say you have a patient whose risk is 10% in 10 years, and you put her on a statin, and you take that statin religiously and you lower your risk by 30%, your risk is now 7%. If you then also take a medicine that increases your risk by 50%, Now you're back up to 10%. So the risks are additive and subtractive to each other. And so just remember that as you're doing all this hard work to lower your risk, that you don't do something that increases your risk. And that would certainly be true with various lifestyle choices and so forth. Taking a statin will lower your risk, smoking will increase your risk, and you've competed. Doesn't mean it doesn't help, because the risk would be even higher if you were on NSAIDs and didn't take the statin, but you've counteracted the two. So pay attention to these kind of issues. So this is not proven yet, but this is concerning. And so that's why many of your physicians, even though the anti-inflammatory drugs can be quite useful, they have side effects to the stomach and the kidneys as well. But this is one of the reasons why people have become a little bit more conservative with those medicines. All right, so let me wrap up, and we'll take questions for the remainder. Statins are effective and cost-effective in groups of patients. We don't know what age to screen at, but if you believe in screening at age 21, what you're thinking you should do is find the people with the genetic disorders. Otherwise, you can probably wait. If there's not a striking family history, you can probably wait to 35 in men and 45 in women. As we talked about, you want to use statins in people who have vascular disease, have a high LDL and diabetes, and those without the disease whose risk is over a certain number. That number is probably should be 7.5% to 15%. We don't know exactly where the right cut point is, and we don't still know exactly which risk assessment to use, but you can use two or three of them, see where you land. Use the right intensity statins, that is mostly the high and moderate intensities. It's important to monitor adherence. We want to make sure not only that you're taking the pill, which we can usually do by just talking, but also to make sure that the pill is working. So we will check follow-up blood tests to make sure you're getting that 30 to 50% reduction. But we won't check it every 6 months or every year the way we used to. You know, once we know you're in a stable regimen, the drug is working, we may start backing off on checking it as often. The drugs don't work very well in patients on dialysis who have bad heart failure. The evidence is accumulating that the other drugs don't add much value unless the patient truly can't take statins, and avoid other risk factors, other factors that raise risk as much as statins. And the first on my list for this is anti-inflammatory drugs. With that, I'll stop and thank you very much for your attention.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.